There's a strange moment that happens right before you lose control of your mind, and it's so fast you almost never catch it. It's that tiny spark where something happens out there in the world, and then, quietly, automatically, you turn it into a story inside your head, and the story feels so real that you forget you wrote it. You forget you're the one holding the pen, and suddenly you're not reacting to reality anymore. You're reacting to your own interpretation of reality. And in that one hidden step, your peace gets traded away without you even noticing the price. Marcus Aurelius knew that moment intimately, not as a motivational idea, not as a quote for a poster, but as a daily battle fought in the middle of pressure and responsibility, writing private notes to himself in the second century while leading an empire and spending long stretches away from comfort in the messy human reality of fatigue, politics, loss, and people who disappointed him. Exactly the kind of world where master your mind isn't a slogan, it's survival. And what I love about his thinking is that it doesn't ask you to become emotionless. It asks you to become honest, to see the machinery of your mind clearly enough that you can stop being dragged around by it. So if you're listening right now and part of you feels tired, tired of overthinking, tired of mood swings you can't explain, tired of giving your best energy to people who don't deserve it, then let's take this hour, or this walk, or this quiet corner of your day and make it a kind of training ground, because the mind can be trained the same way the body can, not with one dramatic transformation, but with repeated, gentle corrections. And with one simple skill that grows over time, the ability to pause between what happens and what you decide it means. And here's a small thing you can do as we begin, something you don't need to write down or perform for anyone. Just pick one situation in your life that has been stealing your peace lately. Maybe it's a person, maybe it's a problem, maybe it's your own habits, and just hold it lightly in the background while you listen. Not to judge yourself, not to spiral into it, but to use it as a real-world test, because if these lessons can't touch your actual life, they're just entertainment, and you don't need more entertainment. You need leverage. The promise of Stoicism, when it's done right, is not that nothing will hurt you, because of course things will hurt you. You're human, you care, you attach, you hope, you get surprised, you get disappointed. But the promise is that you don't have to be mentally conquered by every sensation, every comment, every delay, every rejection, every headline, every memory that shows up uninvited at midnight. And that's what master your mind really means in practice. You feel what you feel, but you don't surrender the steering wheel. Over the next 10 lessons, we're going to move through some of the most practical ideas Marcus returned to again and again. How perception creates suffering, how anger taxes the soul, how to retreat inward even when life is loud, how to stop taking people personally without turning cold, how to loosen your grip on opinions that don't serve you, how to zoom out until anxiety loses its grip, how to anchor yourself in the present without pretending the future doesn't matter, how kindness can be a form of strength, how remembering death can clarify life, and how acceptance isn't weakness but alignment with reality. And I want to be clear about something from the start, because it changes everything. This isn't about becoming passive, it's about becoming precise, because the person who can control their inner world doesn't become smaller, they become freer. And freedom is not doing whatever you want. Freedom is not being forced to do what your impulses want. It's the quiet power of choosing your response, even when you're provoked, even when you're tired, even when you're misunderstood, even when the world doesn't cooperate. If that sounds big, good, because it is big, but it's also built from small moments, small pauses, small reframes, small decisions. And the first lesson begins exactly where your life actually happens, in the split second between an event and the meaning you attach to it, the place where your suffering either starts or ends. Lesson 1, the separation of event and perception. There's a quiet kind of power in realizing that most of your pain isn't coming from what happened. It's coming from what you decided what happened means, and I don't say that to blame you, because this is one of the most human things about us, and it's also one of the most hopeful things, because if the meaning is something your mind adds, then your mind can also learn to add a different meaning, or, sometimes even more freeing, to add no meaning at all. Marcus Aurelius keeps circling this idea in his private notes because he understood that the world is going to keep delivering events the way the ocean delivers waves. And if every wave knocks you down, you don't need a different ocean. You need better footing. And the footing is this. The event is the event. And your perception is your perception. And the two are not the same thing, even though they feel fused when you're emotional. Someone cuts you off in traffic. That's the event. A message gets left on read. That's the event. A coworker makes a comment that lands wrong. That's the event. Your brain, in a fraction of a second, builds the story. They disrespected me. I'm not important. They're trying to make me look small. This always happens. I can't win. And the story arrives with such confidence that it doesn't feel like a story. It feels like reality itself. And suddenly, you're not dealing with a car, a message, or a comment. You're dealing with a whole universe of meaning that your mind constructed in the dark. And the Stoic move is not to pretend you didn't feel it, not to suppress it, not to act like you're above it, but to slow down enough to separate the pieces. Marcus echoes an idea also captured clearly by Epictetus. It's not things themselves that disturb us, but the judgments we make about them. When you really let that land, you start seeing how often you've been fighting ghosts, how often you've been trying to win arguments against interpretations, how often you've been bleeding from stories rather than from facts. So let's make this real, not theoretical. Think about the last time your mood got hijacked, even for 5 minutes. Maybe it was a small disrespect. Maybe it was criticism. Maybe it was someone being distant. If we freeze the moment like a photograph, what exactly happened in the physical world? What was said? What was done? What was the literal, measurable event? And then, this is where your freedom hides. What did you immediately tell yourself about it? What meaning did you attach to it? Did you make it about your worth, about your future, about what people always do, about what life never gives you? Because most suffering is not a direct hit, it's an echo chamber, and your mind is the room. Here's what mastery looks like in this lesson. You train yourself to insert one clean question between the event and the story. Not a complicated meditation, just one question you can ask while your heart is speeding up and your mind is getting loud. What part of this is fact and what part is my interpretation? That question sounds simple, but it has the power to break a spell. And once the spell breaks, you can choose your next move from clarity instead of adrenaline. A lot of people assume this means becoming numb. It doesn't. It means becoming accurate. Imagine someone makes a harsh comment about you. The fact might be they said a sentence in a certain tone. That's it. Your interpretation might be they hate me. They're trying to humiliate me. I'm not respected. I'm failing. This proves I'm not good enough. And look closely. Some of those interpretations might be true sometimes. But you don't actually know in that moment. Your mind is guessing, and it's guessing while emotional, which is like trying to steer a car while the windshield is covered in rain. Marcus would tell you, don't hand your inner peace to a guess. So you pull the moment closer. You make it smaller. You make it clean. You see the event without the extra paint. And then you decide what kind of person you want to be inside that moment. This is the deeper Stoic point. You cannot always control what the world throws at you, but you can control what you add to it. And what you add is often the difference between a manageable day and a ruined day. Now here's a subtle thing that almost nobody notices until they practice it. A lot of your interpretations aren't even about the event. They're about old wounds. A neutral event lands on a sensitive spot, and suddenly, you're not reacting to today. You're reacting to 10 years of memories. A short text feels like rejection because you've been abandoned before. A joke feels like humiliation because you were mocked before. A small delay feels like betrayal because you've been let down before. The Stoics didn't have modern psychology language, but they were deeply aware of this. The mind carries impressions, and if you don't examine them, they run your life from underneath. So ask yourself, gently, not harshly, when something triggers you. Am I reacting to the event, or to what this event reminds me of? Because if it's the second one, then the solution isn't to fight the person or fix the world. The solution is to heal the lens you're looking through. And here's the practical move you can try today, in the middle of real life, in the middle of tension. When something happens that spikes your emotion, don't argue with it immediately. Don't send the message. Don't deliver the comeback. Don't make the decision while you're flooded. Just take one slow breath and name the event like a scientist would, in plain language, without adjectives. He raised his voice. She didn't reply. The meeting got moved. I made a mistake. And then name the interpretation separately. I'm telling myself this means I'm disrespected, or I'm telling myself this means I'm not wanted, or I'm telling myself this means I'm doomed. The moment you separate them, you regain space, and in that space, you regain choice. Let me ask you something in the middle of this, and I want you to answer it privately, honestly, without trying to sound strong. How many of your daily stresses are undeniable facts, and how many are meanings you keep automatically adding, even when those meanings cost you your peace? Just sit with that for a second, because this is where your freedom begins. Not in controlling people, but in controlling the stories you let live in your head, rent-free. And the ending of this lesson is simple, but it's not easy, and that's why it's worth it. When you feel yourself spiraling, your job is not to win the story. It's to return to the event, return to the present, return to what's real, and decide your response like a person who respects their own mind. Because the world will always give you events, but only you can give them the power to disturb your soul. And once you start doing that, even imperfectly, something changes. You stop feeling like life is happening to you, and you start feeling like you're meeting life with your eyes open. And that's exactly the kind of inner strength that sets up the next lesson. Because when you understand that perception creates so much of your suffering, you also start seeing what anger really is. Not strength, not justice, not power, but a cost you've been paying without reading the receipt. Listen to the cost of anger. There's a part of anger that feels clean in the moment, almost like it's giving you clarity, like it's finally drawing a line, finally defending you, finally telling the world, you can't treat me like that. And I get why it's seductive, because anger can feel like strength when you're hurt. It can feel like momentum when you're scared. It can feel like control when you feel powerless. But Marcus Aurelius keeps warning himself, almost like a man writing reminders on the walls of his own mind, that anger is one of the most expensive emotions you can rent, because the price isn't paid by the person who triggered it. It's paid by you, with your body, your dignity, your attention, and your ability to think clearly. He says it in a way that lands like a quiet punch. How much more grievous are the consequences of anger than the causes of it? And if you've lived long enough, you already know this is true, because you've seen the cause. It's usually small, a comment, a delay, a misunderstanding, someone's tone, someone's ego. And then you've seen the consequences, and the consequences can be a ruined day, a relationship cracked for months, a decision you can't undo, a reputation damaged, a moment of self-respect lost. And the worst part is that the original cause often disappears within minutes, but the consequences can follow you like a shadow for years. What Stoicism does here is brutally practical. It doesn't ask, is your anger understandable? Because most anger is understandable. It asks, is your anger useful? And even deeper than that, is your anger worth the cost? Because if you're honest, anger rarely improves your life in the way it promises. It promises power, but it often produces weakness. It promises justice, but it often produces regret. It promises respect, but it often makes you look smaller than the person you're angry at. And the most painful truth is this: when you're angry, you are easy to control, because anyone who can predict your reactions can steer you. Think about how anger works in real life. Someone provokes you, and suddenly your focus collapses onto them. Your mind starts rehearsing arguments, your body tightens, your breathing gets shallow, your memory starts collecting evidence of every past wrong, and it's like your inner world becomes a courtroom where you're both the prosecutor and the judge, and for a while you feel righteous, until you notice what you've traded away. You traded away the quiet ability to enjoy your evening. You traded away the depth of presence with your family. You traded away the calm intelligence you usually have. You traded away the version of you that you respect. Marcus was an emperor, and if anyone had reasons to be angry, it was him. Betrayals, incompetence, war, political games. But his writing shows a man who understood something most of us learn late. Anger is not the same as strength. Strength is the ability to hold your ground without losing yourself. Strength is the ability to respond without becoming the thing you hate. Strength is emotional self-command. There's a moment in the history of American baseball that captures this kind of self-command in a way people still talk about. In 1947, when Jackie Robinson broke Major League Baseball's color barrier with the Brooklyn Dodgers, he faced relentless abuse, verbal attacks from crowds, opposing players, even threats meant to humiliate him publicly. Branch Rickey, the Dodgers president, asked Robinson for something that sounded almost impossible: the strength not to fight back for a period of time. Not because Robinson was weak, but because the moment demanded a different kind of power. The kind of power that refuses to be pulled into the opponent's frame. Robinson later described how hard it was, how it felt to swallow fire. But history remembers what that discipline achieved, not just personal success, but a shift in the culture. That's the point here. Sometimes the strongest move is not reacting, not because you're afraid, but because you're strategic. Because you refuse to pay the cost of anger when it benefits the other person more than it benefits you. Now, none of this means you let people walk over you. Stoicism isn't submission, it's precision. You can set boundaries with a calm voice. You can leave with dignity. You can say no without venom. You can correct someone without burning yourself down. In fact, Calm boundaries are often more terrifying to toxic people than angry ones, because anger signals they still have access to you, but calm signals you've reclaimed yourself. So here's the key shift Marcus is trying to install in his mind, and it's worth installing in yours. Instead of asking, "Do I have the right to be angry?" ask, "What will this anger cost me in the next hour? And the next week?" Because anger has hidden fees. It costs you health, stress hormones, blood pressure, sleep. It costs you clarity, because anger narrows your thinking like a tunnel. It costs you communication, because once you're angry, you start speaking to win, not to understand. And it costs you identity, because you start acting like a person you don't even like. If you want a practical tool, something you can actually do the next time you feel that heat rising, try this. Treat anger like a business decision. Before you act, run the numbers. If I send this message right now, what do I gain? And then, what do I lose? And be honest. Most of the time, what you gain is a temporary feeling of release, and what you lose is peace, respect, and leverage. And if you can't think clearly enough to run the numbers, that itself is the signal that you shouldn't act yet. Here's another move Marcus would respect, because it's rooted in reality. Delay is power. When you feel anger, don't trust the first impulse. Give yourself a small delay, 30 seconds, 1 minute, a short walk to the kitchen, a glass of water. Because anger is like a wave, and waves peak and fall if you don't feed them. Most people don't realize they keep anger alive by replaying the story, by rehearsing the speech, by imagining the confrontation. If you stop feeding it, it weakens. That's not avoidance, that's mastery. Let me ask you something that might sting a little, but it's worth asking. How many times have you called your anger standards when it was really just a wounded ego demanding payment? And how many times have you called it honesty when it was really just an emotional explosion wearing a costume? The Stoic path is not about becoming nicer. It's about becoming truer. And truth includes this. Anger often feels like it's protecting you, but it's usually exposing you. So the lesson isn't never feel anger. The lesson is never let anger drive. Feel it, notice it, name it, but don't hand it your mouth, don't hand it your hands, don't hand it your decisions. Because the person who can feel anger and still choose restraint is not weak, they are rare. And once you start living this, you begin to feel something you might not expect. Calm becomes addictive in the best way. Not the calm of avoidance, but the calm of self-respect. The calm of knowing you didn't abandon yourself in a moment of heat. And that naturally opens the door to the next lesson. Because when you stop leaking your energy through anger, you start noticing you need a place to return to. A place inside you that isn't shaken by noise at all. A kind of inner refuge Marcus called the quiet retreat of the soul. Lesson 3. The retreat into the inner citadel. There's a kind of exhaustion that isn't coming from work, or from responsibility, or even from problems. It's coming from the fact that your mind never has a safe place to return to, because every time life gets loud, you go outward. You chase relief in noise. You chase certainty in arguments. You chase comfort in distractions. And for a moment it works, and then it doesn't. And then you're right back in the same inner chaos, except now you're tired on top of it. And Marcus Aurelius, writing to himself like a man who had no choice but to become his own therapist, offers a line that feels like a door hidden in a wall. Nowhere can man find a quieter or more untroubled retreat than in his own soul. When people hear that, they sometimes imagine it as some mystical thing, like you need perfect meditation skills or a special personality type to access it. But Marcus wasn't writing for monks. He was writing for himself on hard days, surrounded by the mess of human behavior, and what he's really pointing to is a practical truth. Peace is not a location, it's a setting, and if you don't learn how to access that setting internally, then no vacation, no new relationship, no new house, no new city will ever permanently fix the restlessness, because you'll bring the same unsettled mind with you wherever you go. Think about how modern life works. Your phone vibrates, someone's opinion hits you, news floods your attention, you're pulled into little emotional storms all day. And after a while it starts to feel normal to live like that. Like you're supposed to be reactive. Like you're supposed to carry everyone's energy. Like you're supposed to have an opinion on everything and be available to everyone. But the Stoics would call that a kind of inner slavery. Not because anyone is physically chaining you, but because your mind is constantly being dragged by external forces, and you don't even notice it happening because it's become your baseline. The inner citadel is Marcus's answer to that. It's the idea that you can build a part of you that remains intact no matter what's happening outside. Not because you're detached from life, but because you're anchored within it. And what's beautiful is how simple the entry point is. You withdraw attention from the outer noise and bring it back to what you can govern, your judgments, your intentions, your actions in the next moment. That's it. You stop trying to control the whole weather of the world and you start tending to the climate of your own mind. Let's make it real. Imagine you're in a room where someone is being difficult. Maybe they're passive-aggressive, maybe they're unfair, maybe they're just chaotic. And you can feel yourself being pulled, like your nervous system is getting yanked toward them. Most people in that moment either fight, freeze, or perform. They argue, they shut down, they try to please. But the inner citadel is a fourth option. You stay present, but you stop handing them access to your inner state. You recognize quietly that their behavior exists, but it does not have to become your mental home. You can interact from a place that is deeper than irritation. Marcus is essentially saying, you don't need the world to be quiet for you to be quiet. You don't need people to behave well for you to behave well. You don't need a perfect environment to have an ordered mind. That's a radical kind of independence. And this is where the practice becomes very concrete, because retreat into your soul can sound poetic until you try it in the middle of traffic or conflict or stress. So here's what it looks like in daily life. It's a micro retreat. A few seconds where you step back inside yourself. You relax your jaw. You lower your shoulders. You take one slower breath than the situation deserves. You remind yourself, my mind is my responsibility. And then you choose one clear value to act from. Patience, courage, honesty, restraint, kindness, whatever fits the moment. Like you're selecting a tool instead of swinging wildly with emotion. If you've ever watched a great athlete under pressure, you've seen a version of this. They don't look frantic. They don't look rushed. They look like they have time. Even when they don't. That's not luck, that's training. And your mind can be trained the same way. The inner citadel is basically mental composure as a trained skill. There's a historical example that fits this idea in a way that's almost painfully clear. In 1914, when Ernest Shackleton's ship Endurance became trapped in Antarctic ice and the expedition turned into a fight for survival, Shackleton's leadership wasn't just about decisions, it was about emotional steadiness. The men were surrounded by endless white, isolation, danger, uncertainty, and yet again and again, Shackleton maintained a kind of internal order that influenced everyone around him. He controlled what could be controlled. Routines, morale, clear priorities, calm communication, and he refused to let panic run the camp. That's the inner citadel in real life. When the outside becomes hostile, you don't demand comfort, you create stability from within, and that stability becomes contagious. Now, I want to bring this closer to you, because you might not be stuck in Antarctic ice, but you might be stuck in something else. Financial pressure, family tension, uncertainty about the future, loneliness, ambition mixed with fear. And the question isn't, how do I make the world easier? The question is, how do I become steadier inside the world I'm already in? The Stoic answer is, build the fortress within, and you build it through repetition, not through inspiration. You build it by practicing small withdrawals from chaos. You build it by refusing to rehearse every worry. You build it by stopping the mental habit of scanning for threats all day. You build it by returning to the present, returning to your breath, returning to your next right action. And over time, you develop a home inside yourself, a place you can go even when you can't physically leave. Here's a practical move you can try today, and it's simple enough that you'll actually do it. Pick one moment each day that is already happening. Maybe it's the moment you sit in your car before you step out. Maybe it's the moment you wash your hands. Maybe it's the moment you wait for your coffee. Maybe it's the moment you close a laptop. In that moment, practice a 10-second retreat. No phone, no thinking about the next thing. Just 10 seconds of returning inward and asking, what is my mind doing right now? And then gently choosing, what do I want it to do? You're not forcing peace. You're remembering you have authority. And I want to ask you something that matters here, because this lesson is not about being calm in theory. It's about being calm when it counts. If you had a real inner refuge, something you could access in 10 seconds, how would that change the way you handle disrespect, disappointment, uncertainty, and pressure? Would you still chase explanations? Would you still collapse into overthinking? Would you still hand your mood to other people's behavior? Or would you become the kind of person who can stand in noise without becoming noisy inside? The inner citadel is not an escape from life. It's a way of meeting life without being shattered by it. And once you start building that, you naturally start seeing other people differently, because when you have a stable inner base, you no longer need to make someone else the villain of your day just to explain your discomfort. And that opens the next lesson almost automatically. The people who provoke you are often not masterminds of evil. They're confused, ignorant, hurt, and acting out their own inner chaos. And Marcus begins his mornings by reminding himself of exactly that, not to become bitter, but to become prepared. Lesson 4, the ignorance of the offender. One of the hardest truths to swallow, especially when you've been disrespected, misunderstood, or treated unfairly, is that the person in front of you might not be against you in the dramatic way your mind wants to believe. They might simply be lost inside themselves. And Marcus Aurelius, who had to deal with more human ego in a day than most of us deal with in a month, wrote himself a morning reminder that isn't cynical. It's preventative, like emotional armor you put on before stepping into the world. When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. At first glance, it sounds harsh, like he's labeling people, but if you read it the way he meant it, it's actually compassion mixed with realism, because he's not saying, people are evil, hate them. He's saying, people are human, expect friction. He's not trying to harden his heart. He's trying to keep his mind from being surprised by what he already knows is common. And that matters, because surprise is what turns irritation into rage. Surprise is what makes you take things personally. Surprise is what makes you think, How could they do this, as if you just discovered a new species? Marcus is doing something quietly brilliant here. He's separating your expectations from your peace. If you walk into the day expecting everyone to be fair, mature, grateful, emotionally regulated and wise, you are basically signing a contract to suffer. Not because those qualities are bad to hope for, but because you're building your inner stability on something you don't control, other people's level of consciousness. And once your stability depends on that, you're fragile. You're one rude comment away from losing your center. So the Stoic move is to accept that people will be imperfect, sometimes badly imperfect, and then to ask a different question. What is driving this person? Because when you understand the driver, you stop reading everything as a personal attack. You start seeing patterns. You start seeing pain. You start seeing insecurity. You start seeing confusion. And that changes your emotional response in a way that isn't weakness. It's intelligence. Here's the core idea Marcus repeats in different ways. People do wrong because they don't know what's good. They mistake status for worth. They mistake dominance for strength. They mistake control for safety. They mistake attention for love. And when you really believe that, something inside you loosens, because you stop assuming that the person who hurt you is sitting somewhere calmly plotting your downfall. Most of the time they're just reacting to their own fear, their own jealousy, their own emptiness, their own need to feel important for 5 seconds. That doesn't excuse behavior, it explains it. And explanation is powerful because it gives you options. When you think they're evil, your only options feel like war or surrender. But when you think they're ignorant, suddenly you have a third option, composure. You can protect yourself without poisoning yourself. You can respond firmly without becoming cruel. You can set a boundary without needing revenge. Let's take a very common situation. Someone speaks to you with disrespect. The immediate interpretation is, they're trying to make me small, and sometimes that might be true. But even then, ask what's behind it. People who are secure don't need to humiliate. People who are at peace don't need to provoke. People who know their worth don't need to steal yours. So disrespect often reveals more about the inner state of the offender than about the value of the person receiving it. And that's the emotional pivot Marcus is inviting you into. Stop treating other people's dysfunction as a verdict on you. If you want a real historical picture of this kind of mental strength, look at Viktor Frankl during World War II. Frankl, an Austrian psychiatrist, was imprisoned in Nazi concentration camps beginning in 1942, and he wrote later about how the last of human freedoms is the ability to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstances. What's relevant here isn't turning him into a symbol, it's the fact that he recognized something terrifying and liberating. When someone is cruel, the cruelty is often a manifestation of their own inner collapse. Frankl didn't romanticize evil, but he understood that dehumanizing behavior frequently comes from a damaged mind and a corrupted value system, and he aimed his focus at preserving his own inner dignity. That's the Stoic path under extreme conditions, not denying the injustice, but refusing to let the offender define your inner world. Now, bring this back to normal life, because your battlefield might be a workplace, a family dynamic, a relationship, or even strangers online. The principle holds. If you take every offense personally, you will spend your life emotionally bleeding from other people's cuts, and the offender will keep walking through life unchanged while you carry the wound. But if you learn to see the ignorance beneath the offense, you can keep your self-respect intact while still protecting your boundaries. This is where people often misunderstand Stoicism and think it's just forgive everyone. That's not it. Marcus isn't telling you to keep toxic people close. He's telling you to stop handing them the power to disturb your soul. You can forgive internally and still leave externally. You can have compassion and still say no access. You can understand someone's pain and still refuse their behavior. So here's a practical move you can use the next time someone irritates or disrespects you. Before you respond, silently translate their behavior into a likely inner state. Not as a diagnosis, not as a moral judgment, just as a grounded guess. This feels like insecurity. This feels like fear. This feels like envy. This feels like someone trying to feel powerful. And then add one more sentence. I don't have to drink this. Because that's what taking things personally is. It's drinking someone else's poison and hoping it hurts them. The Stoic refuses that transaction. And there's another layer that's almost uncomfortable, but it's honest. Sometimes the reason certain people trigger you is because they touch something unresolved in you. Their arrogance touches your doubt. Their rejection touches your need. Their criticism touches your insecurity. And that doesn't mean you deserve mistreatment. It means the trigger is an invitation to strengthen a weak spot. Marcus would want you to see that not as shame, but as training. Every offender becomes a teacher, not because what they did was good, but because it reveals where your inner citadel still has an open gate. Let me ask you something quietly as you're listening. Who is the person you keep calling toxic in your head? And what if part of your freedom is accepting that they may never change and still choosing to remain steady anyway? Because once you stop waiting for them to become reasonable, you stop giving them control over your emotional weather. This lesson ends with a kind of calm readiness. You step into the day not naive, not bitter, but prepared. You expect human flaws, and because you expect them, they lose their power to shock you. And that naturally sets up what comes next. Because once you stop taking people's behavior personally, you also stop feeling obligated to have a judgment about everything they do, everything the world does, everything life throws at you. And Marcus points to a freedom that almost feels illegal in modern life, the option to have no opinion at all. Lesson 5. The Art of Having No Opinion. There's a kind of inner noise that people mistake for intelligence, and it shows up as constant judgment, judging the news, judging strangers, judging the way someone talks, the way someone lives, judging yourself, judging your past, judging your future. And it can feel like you're staying aware, like you're being sharp, like you're protecting yourself. But if you're honest, it often just keeps your nervous system on a slow boil, because every judgment is a tiny argument your mind starts having with reality. And Marcus Aurelius, with the calm bluntness of someone who has tested his own mind under pressure, gives you a permission slip that changes the whole emotional economy. You always own the option of having no opinion. There is never any need to get worked up or to trouble your soul about things you can't control. When you first hear that, it might sound like apathy, like you're supposed to stop caring. But it's not apathy, it's selectivity. It's the ability to decide what deserves a reaction and what doesn't. It's emotional minimalism. And in a world that constantly tries to recruit your attention, your outrage, your fear, your tribal loyalty, having no opinion is not weakness, it's freedom. It's you refusing to be conscripted into every little mental war that passes by. The truth is, most of us don't realize how often we create suffering by adding an opinion where none is needed. You're standing in line and someone is slow, and instantly the mind says, "People are so inconsiderate." You see a post online and instantly the mind says, This is ridiculous. Someone disagrees with you, and instantly the mind says, they're ignorant. The event might be neutral, but the opinion turns it into a personal problem. And then we wonder why we feel exhausted, even on days where nothing objectively terrible happened. Marcus is pointing to a radical choice. You can witness something without attaching yourself to it. You can observe without signing a contract. You can let the world be messy without making your inner world messy too. And this isn't just philosophical. This has real consequences for your focus, your health, your relationships, your ability to sleep at night. Because when you carry opinions about everything, you carry emotional weight about everything. And the mind was never built to hold that much. Think of your attention like a budget. Every opinion is a purchase. Some purchases are worth it. Your values, your family, your mission, your character, the things you can actually influence. But most opinions are impulse spending. You buy a reaction you don't need, and then you pay interest on it for hours. A small annoyance turns into a mood. A small disagreement turns into a narrative. A small imperfection turns into a day that feels heavy. And the person you're reacting to often doesn't even know you're paying. This is why the Stoic practice here is so clean. Stop giving your attention away for free, because attention is life. What you stare at grows in your mind, and if you stare at what irritates you all day, you become an irritated person. Not because the world forced you, but because you trained yourself to live there. There's a historical example that illustrates the power of selective opinion in a way that feels almost like a superpower. During World War II, British codebreakers at Bletchley Park, including Alan Turing and the teams working on decrypting German communications, were under intense pressure, massive stakes, secrecy, long hours, constant urgency, and the work demanded a rare kind of mental discipline. You could not afford to react emotionally to every setback, every false lead, every frustrating pattern, because emotional reactivity would destroy precision. The mind had to stay clear. It wasn't about being cold, it was about keeping the signal clean. In your life, the stakes may not be wartime intelligence, but the principle holds. Clarity requires that you stop contaminating your mind with unnecessary judgments. Now, here's where it gets personal, because having no opinion often triggers a fear. If I don't judge this, does that mean I'm letting it slide? If I don't react, does that mean I'm weak? If I don't take a side, does that mean I'm naive? And the Stoic answer is subtle. You can still act without being internally disturbed. You can still set boundaries without emotional drama. You can still make decisions without resentment. In fact, you make better decisions when your mind isn't busy performing outrage. So the practice is not to become indifferent to your values. The practice is to become indifferent to the things that aren't yours to carry. Marcus would want you to ask again and again, is this within my control? And if it's not, then you have permission to release the opinion that's trying to latch onto it like a hook. Not because it doesn't matter in the universe, but because it doesn't need to matter inside your nervous system. Here's a practical way to do this that you can use today without changing your whole personality. When something happens that tries to trigger a judgment, try replacing your opinion with a neutral description. Instead of, that person is disrespectful, you say internally, that person spoke sharply. Instead of, this situation is terrible, you say, this is inconvenient. Instead of, my life is falling apart, you say, I'm facing uncertainty. You're not denying reality. You're removing the emotional poison from the language. Because language is a steering wheel. The words you use inside your head drive the emotional car. And then, when you can, go one step further into the heart of this lesson. Deliberately choose no opinion as a response. Not out loud, you don't have to say it to anyone, just internally. I have no opinion on this. It's almost comical how freeing it feels when you actually do it. It's like you stop gripping a hot pan you forgot you were holding. You realize you've been voluntarily participating in stress. Let me ask you a question that might reveal how much weight you've been carrying. How many opinions do you have that have never improved your life even once? Opinions about strangers. Opinions about other people's lifestyles. Opinions about the way the world should be. Opinions about the past. Opinions about the future. If you removed those opinions, would you lose wisdom or would you gain peace? Because peace is not laziness. Peace is the absence of unnecessary inner conflict. And a huge percentage of inner conflict is self-created. That's not an insult. It's a gift, because it means you can change it. Now, there's another layer here, and it's one Marcus would recognize immediately. Many opinions are a form of ego protection. If I judge first, I feel safer. If I label someone, I feel superior. If I criticize, I avoid vulnerability. And the Stoic path asks you to give up that cheap safety in exchange for something deeper, steadiness. You don't need to be superior to be safe. You need to be grounded. And groundedness comes from regulating what you allow into your inner world. So the lesson ends with a quiet invitation. Let most things pass through you like weather. You can notice the clouds without becoming the storm. Save your judgments for what you can actually shape: your character, your choices, your commitments. And once you start doing that, something almost inevitable happens. Your mind gets lighter, your attention gets sharper, and you begin to see your problems in a new way. Because when you stop reacting to everything, you finally have the calm space to zoom out. And that's exactly where the next lesson takes you, because perspective, real perspective, has a way of shrinking anxiety down to its true size. Lesson 6. The view from above. There's a certain kind of panic that only exists when you're zoomed in too close, like your face is pressed against the glass of one single moment, one single problem, one single conversation, and the mind starts acting like this is the whole universe, like this one thing is destiny, like everything depends on it. And Marcus Aurelius, who spent years living with the weight of decisions that affected millions, kept reminding himself to do something that sounds almost poetic, but is actually one of the most practical mental skills you can develop. Change the altitude of your attention, because when you rise above the moment stops owning you. He writes in his quiet, self-directed way, "Think of substance in its entirety, of which you have the smallest share, and of time in its entirety, of which a brief and momentary span has been assigned to you." This is the view from above. It's the Stoic practice of perspective, not the fake perspective that dismisses your problems, but the real perspective that puts your problems in their true proportion so you can finally respond like an adult instead of like a wounded child. When you're anxious, your mind is usually doing one of two things. It's either catastrophizing, turning a challenge into a disaster in advance, or it's obsessing, replaying details like the repetition will produce control. Both are forms of zooming in. Both make your world smaller. And the smaller your world becomes, the heavier everything feels. A delayed reply becomes rejection. A mistake becomes identity. A disagreement becomes war. A setback becomes proof. This is not because your life is uniquely doomed. It's because your mind is stuck in a tight frame. The view from above widens the frame. And I want to say something important. This practice isn't about telling yourself nothing matters. That's not stoicism. That's despair dressed up as philosophy. Stoicism says some things matter deeply, but you can't think clearly about them while you're drowning in the moment. Perspective doesn't remove meaning, it cleans it. It separates what's urgent from what's truly important. It stops you from making permanent decisions based on temporary emotions. So, what does this look like in real life? Let's say you're stressed about a conflict with someone. Right now, it feels like this conflict is the entire emotional landscape of your week. The view from above says, step back. First, imagine you're watching this scene from the ceiling of the room. You see two human beings, both tired, both wanting to be understood, both carrying invisible histories. Then step back further. Imagine your building from above, then your city, then your country, then the planet. Not to make yourself small, but to remember scale. To remember that your nervous system is reacting as if this is life or death, when it's often life and life, moment and moment, ego and ego. Now take it one level closer to home, because cosmic scale can feel too abstract. Use time. Imagine your life 5 years from now. Will this moment still feel like a crisis? Will it be a memory? Will it be a lesson? Will it be something you laugh at? Even if it's serious, will it still deserve the intensity you're giving it right now? The view from above is basically you borrowing the calm wisdom of your future self and bringing it into the present. And if you want something even more grounded, use history. This is where Marcus's own life becomes strangely comforting. He wrote these meditations in the Roman Empire in the 2nd century, during years marked by war and plague, leadership stress, betrayal, uncertainty, things that would break many people. And yet here we are, almost 2,000 years later, reading the private thoughts of a man who worried, who struggled, who tried to be good anyway. That fact alone is the view from above. Your current crisis feels enormous, but human beings have been facing fear, loss, conflict, and uncertainty for thousands of years. And they've endured, they've adapted, they've rebuilt, and many of them found meaning in the process. There's a historical image I find useful here because it captures perspective without pretending pain is trivial. In 1968, during the Apollo 8 mission, the astronauts captured the famous Earthrise photograph, Earth rising over the lunar horizon. That image changed how people saw the planet, not because it erased problems, but because it revealed how small and shared our home actually is. The view from above works the same way inside your mind. You don't stop caring. You stop exaggerating. You start seeing your life as part of something larger, and that reduces the emotional intensity enough for wisdom to enter the room. Now, here's the part that matters most. Perspective is not a one-time insight. It's a practice. Anxiety will always try to pull you back into the tight frame because the mind loves drama. It loves the illusion of control that comes from obsession. So, you need a repeated ritual of zooming out, like you're resetting the lens every day. Try this as a simple daily practice. When something is bothering you, ask yourself, how big will this be in 1 week, 1 year, 10 years? You don't have to answer perfectly. The question itself widens the frame. Or ask, is this a mountain or is it a hill? I'm calling a mountain because I'm tired. Because exhaustion is a magnifying glass. When you're depleted, everything looks worse. The view from above returns you to proportion. And here's a surprising side effect. When you zoom out, you often become kinder. Not in a soft way, but in a clear way. You realize people are not characters in your story. They are the main characters in their own stories. You realize everyone is fighting something invisible. You realize you've been interpreting everything as personal when it's often just human. And that doesn't make you naive. It makes you less easily manipulated. Let me ask you a question right here, and I want you to be honest with yourself. What problem in your life has been living in your head like it's the entire universe, when it might actually be one chapter, one scene, one moment in a long life? And if you truly believed that, how would you act differently today? Would you still panic? Would you still rush? Would you still beg for certainty? Or would you slow down, breathe, and take one clean step? Because that's what perspective ultimately gives you, the ability to take one clean step. And once you experience that, you start noticing something else. The more you zoom out, the more you realize the only moment you can actually touch is the present moment, not yesterday, not tomorrow, not the hypothetical future your mind keeps trying to live in. Perspective naturally brings you back to the now, not as a cliche, but as an anchor. And that's where the next lesson begins, because Marcus repeats it like a mantra for a reason. Calm is not found in controlling the future. It's found in confining yourself to what is here, what is real, what is happening right now. Lesson 7. The present moment as an anchor. There's a specific kind of suffering that doesn't come from what's happening. It comes from what isn't happening, from the future you're trying to manage in your head, from the past you're trying to rewrite, from the imaginary conversations you keep having with people who aren't even in the room. And Marcus Aurelius, who knew what it felt like to wake up with pressure waiting for him like a shadow, kept returning to one instruction that sounds almost too simple until you live it. Confine yourself to the present. Not ignore the future. Not pretend the past didn't happen. Not become a floating spiritual person who doesn't care about consequences. But confine yourself, meaning stop letting your mind roam without supervision. Because an unsupervised mind doesn't wander into peace. It wanders into worry. It wanders into regret. It wanders into endless rehearsal. And the strange thing is, we often treat that wandering as if it's responsibility. We call it planning. We call it processing. We call it being realistic. But so much of it is just mental noise disguised as maturity. The Stoic insight here is surgical. You can only bear the present. You were built to handle what is in front of you, right now, in this breath, in this step, in this conversation. The present moment is usually manageable. It might be uncomfortable, but it's manageable. What breaks you is the extra weight your mind adds, the 5 different futures it predicts, the 10 different ways it replays the past, the constant what-if soundtrack that keeps your body in a state of tension, even when you're sitting in a quiet room. This is why anxiety feels like drowning. You're not drowning in reality. You're drowning in time. You're trying to live in 10 minutes from now, 10 days from now, 10 years from now, and your nervous system can't tell the difference between an imagined threat and a real one, so it pumps you full of stress as if you're in danger, and then you wonder why you can't sleep, why you can't focus, why even good moments feel thin. Marcus is offering a way out. Anchor your attention in what exists. And the word anchor matters, because an anchor doesn't remove the waves. The ocean can still be wild. The wind can still be loud. But an anchored ship doesn't drift into rocks. In your life, the waves might be deadlines, uncertainty, grief, family tension, ambition, loneliness, health worries, all real things. And anchoring in the present doesn't deny them. It just stops you from being dragged around by mental projections. So what does anchoring look like? It's not a posture. It's not a perfect calm face. It's a choice you make again and again. What is the next real thing I can do? Not the next 10 things. Not the perfect plan for the next year. Just the next real thing. That single shift is one of the most powerful ways to regain control of your mind, because it turns anxiety into action and turns overwhelm into sequence. If you're worried about money, the mind jumps to catastrophe, bills, futures, shame, identity. Anchoring says, what is the next real thing? Maybe it's opening your bank app and looking at the number without flinching. Maybe it's sending one email. Maybe it's making one small budget decision today. If you're worried about a relationship, the mind jumps to endings and betrayal and loneliness. Anchoring says, what is the next real thing? Maybe it's one honest conversation. Maybe it's one boundary. Maybe it's one decision to stop checking your phone like it's an oxygen tank. If you're worried about your health, the mind jumps to worst-case stories. Anchoring says, what is the next real thing? Maybe it's making an appointment, taking a walk, eating one decent meal, going to bed earlier tonight. The present moment is the only place where your actions can land. Everything else is thought, and thought is useful until it becomes escape or obsession. There's a real historical example that shows how ruthless the present moment can be and how saving it can also be. On January 15, 2009, when US Airways Flight 1549 struck birds shortly after takeoff and lost engine power, Captain Chesley Sully Sullenberger and First Officer Jeffrey Skiles had seconds to decide what to do. There was no time for panic narratives, no time for regret about the past, no time for fear about the future, only the present moment, altitude, airspeed, options, and the next right action. The calm people you admire, whether in emergencies or in everyday leadership, aren't calm because they have fewer problems. They're calm because they live in the next step, not in the disaster movie their mind could play. You might not be landing planes on rivers, but you are landing your days every day. And your mind is either with you or it's somewhere else. So here's the subtle part. Anchoring in the present doesn't mean you never think about the future. It means you think about the future at the right time, in the right way, without sacrificing the present. Planning is a tool. Worry is a habit. And one of the clearest differences between them is this. Planning leads to a next step. Worry leads to more worry. Planning makes you feel a little more grounded. Worry makes you feel more scattered. If your thinking doesn't produce a next step, it's probably not planning. It's probably rumination. Marcus would tell you to cut that off, not with force, but with redirection. The mind says, what if everything goes wrong? You respond, maybe. But what is happening right now? The mind says, I can't believe I said that. You respond, it happened. What can I do now? The mind says, I need certainty. You respond, no one gets certainty. What do I control in this moment? This is not a debate. It's a return. It's a practice of coming home. And there's something else that happens when you truly confine yourself to the present. You regain access to small joys you've been missing. You taste your food. You notice the sky. You hear the tone of someone's voice. You catch your own stress early instead of after it has built into a storm. You realize how many times you've been physically present but mentally absent. And you also realize this is not a moral failure. It's just a habit, and habits can change. Let me ask you a question right here, one that might be uncomfortable, because it's simple. How much of your life have you not actually lived because you were mentally somewhere else? And what would it feel like today, not someday, to come back? So here's a practical move you can use immediately, and it's small enough to be real. When you notice your mind drifting into the past or future, pick one physical anchor and return to it. Feel your feet on the ground. Feel your breath entering and leaving. Notice one sound. Notice one object in front of you. You're not doing this to become a meditation person. You're doing it because your mind needs a handle, something real to hold. And then ask, what is the next right action in this moment? That's how you build the muscle. And as you do this, you'll notice a strange shift. When you're anchored in the present, you become harder to provoke. Because most provocation works by pulling you out of yourself, into ego, into fear, into old wounds, into future threats. But a present mind is like a steady flame. It doesn't jump at every gust of wind. And that naturally leads us into the next lesson, because once you're grounded in the present, you can choose responses that are not instinctive, not defensive, not fueled by fear. Responses that actually disarm conflict instead of escalating it. And Marcus points to one of the most underestimated forms of strength a human being can display. Sincere kindness, not as softness, but as invincibility. Lesson 8. The invincibility of kindness. There's a moment in conflict where you can almost feel two paths opening in front of you, like a fork in the road inside your chest. And one path is the one your nervous system wants. Defend, attack, prove, win, punish, make them feel what you felt. And the other path is quieter, almost counterintuitive. And it feels risky because it doesn't give your ego the quick satisfaction. But Marcus Aurelius keeps pointing toward it as a kind of hidden strength. Kindness is invincible, but only when it's sincere, not fawning or pretentious. That line matters because it removes the fake version of kindness, the version that is people-pleasing, the version that is fear, the version that is performance. Marcus isn't telling you to smile while someone disrespects you. He's not telling you to be a doormat. He's talking about a calm, grounded kind of goodwill that refuses to become an enemy, even when someone is trying to recruit you into a fight. It's not soft. It's disciplined. And in many situations, it's the strongest move available. Most people don't realize how predictable conflict is. Someone provokes, you react. Someone insults, you counter-insult. Someone is cold, you become colder. It's like two mirrors facing each other, reflecting the same energy back and forth until the whole room is filled with it. The problem is that this mirroring feels like justice, but it often just creates more damage. It turns a moment into a pattern. It turns a misunderstanding into a feud. It turns a bad day into a relationship problem. And it turns you into a person who is constantly living on the edge of reaction. Marcus is offering a different kind of mirror. Instead of reflecting their aggression, you reflect your own character. You show them what a regulated human looks like. You respond from your values, not from their mood. And that's why kindness can be invincible. It breaks the chain. It refuses the script. It stops feeding the fire. Now, the word kindness can sound sentimental, so let's translate it into something you can actually use. Sincere kindness is emotional control plus respect for human dignity. It's you saying, through your tone and your actions, I will not dehumanize you, and I will not dehumanize myself. And that changes everything. Because cruelty often escalates when it senses it can drag you down. But when someone meets calm dignity, the dynamic shifts. Some people soften, some people get confused, some people reveal themselves more clearly, and almost always you keep your self-respect intact. Think of the last time you were around someone who stayed calm while everyone else got loud. Maybe they didn't even say much. Maybe they just listened, asked one clear question, spoke with precision, didn't bite on the provocation. That kind of presence is unsettling to people who rely on emotional chaos to gain control. It's like they can't find the buttons, because kindness, when it's sincere and not needy, removes their access. There's a real historical example that illustrates this without turning it into a fairy tale. In the early 1960s, during the American Civil Rights Movement, many activists trained in nonviolent resistance, influenced by leaders like Martin Luther King Jr., faced aggression that was meant to trigger retaliation. The strategic insight, rooted in moral belief and also in psychological realism, was that refusing to return violence with violence could expose injustice and preserve inner dignity. It wasn't passive. It required extraordinary discipline. It took strength to endure provocation without becoming the thing being fought against. That's the kind of invincible Marcus is pointing to. The ability to hold your ground without surrendering your humanity. But let's bring this closer to normal life, because your conflict might be a co-worker who pushes buttons, a family member who speaks in subtle insults, a partner who gets defensive, or a stranger who wants to start something. In those situations, kindness doesn't mean agreeing. It means not escalating. It means responding in a way that doesn't poison you. Here's how it can look in practice, and notice how grounded it is. Someone says something sharp. Instead of firing back, you pause and say calmly, "I hear you," or "Help me understand what you mean," or "I'm not going to talk like this, but I'm willing to talk." That's kindness, not as sweetness, but as structure. You're creating a container where the interaction can return to something human, and if the person refuses, you can still leave with dignity. The kindness was not a negotiation. It was a choice you made about who you are. This is where sincerity becomes everything, because fake kindness is just another form of manipulation, and people can smell it. If you're kind to look good, it's fragile. If you're kind to avoid conflict, it's weak. If you're kind to get something, it's transactional. But if you're kind because you refuse to become bitter, because you value your own mind, because you see that you don't need to win every moment to win your life, that kind of kindness is stable. It doesn't depend on their reaction. And there's another truth here that Marcus would want you to see. Kindness is not only something you give to others, it's something you give to yourself. Because so much of the harshness in your life is internal. It's the way you talk to yourself after a mistake. It's the way you punish yourself for being human. It's the way you replay failures like you're paying a debt. And the Stoic version of kindness is not indulgence, it's fairness. It's you treating yourself with the same sober respect you would offer someone you care about. You correct yourself without cruelty. You hold yourself accountable without hatred. That is invincible too, because self-hatred is one of the easiest ways to lose your mind. Let me ask you a question right here, and it's one that reveals whether kindness is your strength or your fear. When you're kind, is it because you're grounded or because you're afraid? Be honest. Because if it's fear, you'll resent it later. If it's groundedness, you'll feel clean afterwards. You'll feel like you didn't abandon yourself. And that feeling, walking away from a tense moment with your dignity intact, is one of the deepest forms of peace there is. So here's a practical move you can try the next time someone tries to pull you into conflict. Before you respond, silently decide what kind of person you want to be in the next 60 seconds, not what you want them to feel, not how you want the scene to end, who you want to be. Then choose a response that matches that identity. Often that response will be calm, brief, and respectful. That's kindness as a weapon against chaos. And if the situation requires distance, kindness can include leaving. It can include ending the conversation. It can include setting a boundary with a steady tone. Because the goal is not to be nice. The goal is to be unshakable. And once you practice this, you'll notice something that changes the texture of your life. Many conflicts dissolve when you refuse to be an enemy. Not all, some people are committed to chaos, but many. And even when they don't dissolve, you stop carrying the poison afterwards, which means you recover faster, you sleep better, you think clearer, you stay more you. And that leads into the next lesson in a natural way, because sincere kindness is easier when you remember how temporary everything is, how quickly pride fades, how quickly status dissolves, how soon every argument becomes irrelevant in the face of time. And Marcus uses a stark reminder that sounds almost cold until you realize it's actually meant to free you. The transience of all things, the truth that strips away so much pointless suffering. Lesson 9. The transience of all things. There's a certain seriousness the mind puts on things. Status, insult, reputation, money, being right, being seen, being chosen, as if these are permanent pillars holding up your life. And if one of them shakes, everything collapses, and Marcus Aurelius, with that almost startling clarity that comes from someone who lived close to death and responsibility, breaks the spell with a line that feels blunt on purpose. Alexander the Great and his mule driver both died, and the same thing happened to both. It's not meant to be cruel, it's meant to be clarifying. Because the mind, when it's anxious or wounded, forgets the scale of time. It forgets how temporary everything is. It forgets that the person who is humiliating you today will be a memory. It forgets that the moment you're panicking about will become a story you barely tell. It forgets that what feels like a permanent verdict is often just a passing weather system. This is the Stoic practice that later traditions called memento mori. Remember, you will die. And people misunderstand it because they hear it as dark, as depressive, as if you're supposed to walk around thinking about graves all day. But the way Marcus uses it is the opposite of depression. It's a reset. It's like wiping fog off a windshield. It helps you see what matters and what doesn't, because when you remember how short life is, you stop wasting it on nonsense that doesn't deserve your heart. Think about how many hours people spend in emotional prisons built from temporary things. A person said something rude, and you replay it for days. Someone doesn't appreciate you, and you reshape your whole personality to earn their approval. A rival gets ahead, and you let envy poison your mood. A plan doesn't work, and you treat it like fate. Marcus is saying, you are going to die. They are going to die. This moment is going to pass. So why are you giving your life force to something that won't exist in 100 years, and in many cases, won't even matter in 100 days? This isn't about becoming careless. It's about becoming deliberate. Because when you forget death, you start living like everything is urgent, and that urgency gets you trapped in reactive living. But when you remember death, you start living like your attention is precious, which it is. You start asking, is this worth my limited time? And for so many things, the honest answer is no. There's a beautiful historical contrast that makes this feel more than philosophical. In 79 AD, the eruption of Mount Vesuvius buried Pompeii. Ordinary people, shopkeepers, families, citizens, were frozen in a moment that they didn't expect to be their last. The details that probably felt huge to them that morning, arguments, errands, worries, little dramas, were swallowed by a force much bigger than any of it. That doesn't mean their lives didn't matter. It means the mind's dramas are often inflated compared to reality. And remembering that can wake you up. It can bring you back to love, to gratitude, to courage, to the simple act of being alive. Marcus uses transience like a knife that cuts away illusion. The illusion that you'll have endless time to fix things later. The illusion that you need to win every interaction. The illusion that embarrassment is fatal. The illusion that rejection defines you. Transience says, no, everything changes, everything passes, and because everything passes, you have permission to stop gripping so tightly. Now, here's the part that makes this lesson practical instead of just intense. Transience helps you recover faster. When someone insults you, you can ask, will I care about this in a year? And the answer is usually no, and that answer doesn't erase your feeling, but it stops your feeling from becoming a life sentence. When you make a mistake, you can ask, will this moment define my entire story? And the answer is no, and that answer creates room for growth instead of shame. When you're stuck in a conflict, you can ask, is this the hill I want to spend my limited life dying on? And suddenly, you can choose peace without feeling like you lost, because you realize the bigger victory is not giving away time you can never get back. And there's another layer that Marcus would want you to see, because he wasn't just thinking about death as an ending. He was thinking about it as a teacher. Death teaches urgency, but not frantic urgency. A quiet urgency. The kind that makes you say what needs to be said. The kind that makes you apologize without pride. The kind that makes you stop waiting to start living. The kind that makes you choose the meaningful work over the easy distraction. Let me ask you something that hits at the heart of this lesson. If you knew, truly knew, that your life was shorter than you assume, what would you stop wasting your mind on immediately? Which grudges would feel embarrassing to carry? Which arguments would feel like a bad trade? Which fears would lose their grip? And which things would you finally do because you'd realize waiting is also a choice? A choice to let life pass without you fully meeting it. One of the most powerful effects of this practice is how it changes your relationship with other people. When you remember transience, you become less interested in domination and more interested in understanding. Less interested in proving and more interested in connecting. You still set boundaries, but you do it without hatred. You still protect your life, but you do it without bitterness. Because you realize bitterness is a long-term investment in something that won't last, and it steals the only thing that's truly yours, your inner life. So here's a practical move, and it's simple enough to carry with you. The next time you feel yourself getting pulled into a pointless emotional spiral, silently say, "This too will pass." Not as a cliche, but as a factual statement. Then add, "So, what do I want to do with the moments that won't come back?" That second sentence is where your dignity returns. It turns transience into action. And paradoxically, when you remember death, you often become more alive. You notice the warmth of a simple conversation. You appreciate the quiet of an evening. You stop treating your days like they're disposable. You stop postponing your courage. You stop postponing your peace. Because you realize you don't have time to live twice. And that leads into the final lesson in a natural way. Because once you truly accept that everything is temporary, your plans, your status, your comfort, your control, you're ready for the stoic move that ends so much suffering at the root. Stop arguing with reality, stop negotiating with what already is, and meet life the way it arrives, with acceptance, with alignment, with a kind of calm love for fate that turns obstacles into part of the path. Lesson 10, the acceptance of nature. There's a quiet war most people fight every day, and it doesn't look like a war because it happens inside the mind, but it drains you the same way a real war would, because it's the war against what already is, the constant internal argument with reality. Why did this happen? Why are they like this? Why now? Why me? Why isn't life fair? Why didn't it go the way I wanted? And Marcus Aurelius, after watching enough life unfold to understand that reality doesn't negotiate, offers one of the most practical pieces of wisdom ever written, almost comically simple on the surface, but unbelievably deep when you actually live it. The cucumber is bitter? Then throw it out. There are brambles in the path? Then go around them. That's all you need to know. He's not being dismissive. He's describing the physics of peace. Because most suffering is not the problem itself. Most suffering is the extra resistance we add, the refusal, the complaint, the story of how it should have been. The Stoics called it living according to nature, and later thinkers used a phrase like amor fati, the love of fate. But you don't have to make it poetic. In daily life, it means stop wasting your strength fighting facts. Use your strength to respond. Notice how Marcus frames it. Bitter cucumber, remove it. Brambles, go around. He doesn't say, sit there and scream at the cucumber until it becomes sweet. He doesn't say, get angry at the brambles and demand the road become smooth. He accepts the condition and chooses the next intelligent action. That's stoicism at its cleanest. And that one habit, accept, then act, can change your entire life because it removes the most expensive habit the mind has, arguing with reality. Now, acceptance is often misunderstood, so let's clear it up. Acceptance is not surrender. Acceptance is recognition. It's you saying, this is what's here. Surrender is giving up your agency. Acceptance is the beginning of agency. Because you can't solve what you won't acknowledge. You can't navigate a landscape you refuse to see. And many people stay stuck for years, not because their situation is impossible, but because they keep mentally living in an alternate timeline, one where the betrayal didn't happen, where the opportunity didn't vanish, where the person didn't leave, where the mistake wasn't made. And that alternate timeline becomes a prison, because you can't take action in a world that doesn't exist. Marcus is trying to bring you back to the only world where action is possible, this one. There's a historical example that captures this principle with painful clarity. In 1564, when Michelangelo died in Rome, he left behind a life filled with unfinished projects, conflicts, political pressures, changing patrons, and constant demands. But one reason his work still carries such force is that he worked with what was actually in front of him, the block of marble that had cracks, the commission that had constraints, the limitations of the moment. He didn't sit around cursing the universe for not giving him ideal conditions. He made something with the conditions he had. And that's the deeper Stoic message. Nature gives you a raw material, not a perfect script. Your job is to shape the raw material into character, into craft, into meaning. In your life, the bitter cucumber might be a person you can't change. The brambles might be a financial setback. The path might be a health challenge. It might be the fact that you have to start again. It might be the truth that you're not where you thought you'd be. And the mind wants to argue with those facts because arguing feels like control. But it's not control, it's delay. Acceptance says, the situation is here. Now what? And this is where amor fati becomes real, because loving fate doesn't mean loving pain. It means loving the fact that life is giving you something to work with. It means you stop seeing obstacles as insults and start seeing them as assignments. Marcus, leading an empire through hardship, trained himself to see difficulties as part of the natural order. Not personal, not a cosmic attack, just nature unfolding. And once you stop taking reality personally, your nervous system calms down enough for you to move. This lesson also frees you from one of the most exhausting questions humans ask. Why is this happening to me? Sometimes there is a why, sometimes there isn't. But the more useful question is, what does this require from me now? Because that question turns suffering into responsibility, and responsibility is empowering. It returns you to your steering wheel. Here's what acceptance looks like in real time. A plan collapses. Instead of spiraling, you say, okay, that plan is gone. Someone disappoints you. Instead of begging them to become who you wanted them to be, you say, okay, this is who they are right now. You feel fear. Instead of fighting the feeling, you say, okay, fear is here. And then you choose the next step anyway. The okay is not resignation. It's a door opening. It's you stepping out of denial. Now let me ask you something that might reveal where you've been bleeding energy. What fact about your life have you been arguing with for too long? Something you keep revisiting, replaying, negotiating with, wishing away. Because that argument is a hidden tax, and once you pay it for long enough, you start thinking you're weak, when really you're just tired from fighting what can't be changed. Acceptance ends that war. And when the war ends, your energy comes back. So here's a practical move you can use the next time reality hits you in the face. Do it in three steps, quietly, internally. First, name the fact in plain language. Second, remove the moral story. Not, this is unfair. Not, this is the end. Just, this is what happened. Third, choose the smallest effective action you can take next. A call, a boundary, a walk, a rest, a decision, one step. Acceptance plus one step is how you turn fate into a path. And there's a strange peace that comes with this. A peace that doesn't depend on life being easy. It's the peace of alignment. You're no longer fighting the river. You're steering within it. You're no longer demanding perfect weather. You're building a mind that can walk through any weather. And when you put all 10 lessons together, you start seeing the shape of what Marcus was really trying to build in himself. A mind that doesn't panic when events happen because it knows perception is optional. A mind that doesn't worship anger because it knows the cost. A mind that always has a refuge within. A mind that doesn't take offenders personally. A mind that doesn't waste energy on endless opinions. A mind that can zoom out for perspective. A mind that can return to the present. A mind that uses kindness as strength. A mind that remembers everything passes. And a mind that finally stops arguing with nature and starts moving with it. And now, before we close this journey, I want to leave you with one final quiet question to carry into your day. Not as a test, but as a compass. What would change in your life if you stopped trying to control everything outside you, and instead committed to mastering the one place you actually live, your own mind? Thank you for spending this time with me, and for letting these ideas sit with you in a quiet, honest way. I know your attention is valuable, and the fact that you chose to listen all the way through says something good about you. It says you're still trying, still growing, still willing to meet your life with more clarity and strength. As you step back into your day, don't pressure yourself to remember everything. Just take one lesson with you, one small shift, one calmer response, one moment where you catch your mind before it runs away. Because that's how real change happens, quietly, steadily, and from the inside out. Thanks again for listening. Take care of your mind and take care of yourself.